Garçon, coffee.
Welcome to the Coffee and Death Sticks podcast. My name is Kevin Romani.
And I am Danny Marchand.
It's currently at the end of, fuck you, it's January.
Hey Jay, speaking of movies, do you know what month it is?
Fuck you, it's January!
So Danny and I have not seen any new things, really, this month at least. We've gone back and watched some of the previous releases from 2023, and there have been a couple movies and shows that we've wanted to talk about all year, and it just never really fit into an episode, or only one of us had seen it or whatever. So we're going to be doing a series of 2023 catch-up videos in this video's podcast, I should say. It's a video for just Danny and me. That's just for us. It's not for you guys. And this first one's going to be more of a like the crowd pleasers, more traditional go to the movies, see a movie type films. And then we'll kind of do some of the Oscar bait stuff and maybe just some other ones that we've wanted to talk about and some TV shows that we've wanted to talk about. We're going to go all through the year. And I think we're going to start with a couple that came out early in 2023. Danny, what's the first one you'd like to bring up and discuss?
Well, I would obviously like to talk about Cocaine Bear, the final film from celebrated character actor Ray Liotta.
Oh.
Cocaine Bear. This is part of a genre of film. I don't know. I don't have a snappy name for it, but it's Hollywood producers finding out about memes and saying, make that meme a movie. And then they make it a movie. And it's like, not really a movie, is it? It's just kind of a funny anecdote that there was this bear that ate cocaine. Isn't that funny? Is that really a movie? No, it's not.
Right.
That's not a movie. It was fun. Cocaine Bear's fun. It's like harmless, but it just, to quote Peter Griffin from that episode of Family Guy where he talks about The Godfather.
Explain yourself. What didn't you like about it?
It insists upon itself, Lois.
What?
It insists upon itself.
What does that even mean?
It's a little too like, guys, this movie's crazy. Like, look how wacky this movie is. It tells. It doesn't show. And I think that's why it doesn't really work for me.
Yeah, I agree. This, similarly, let's make a movie that can just produce memes. This forced, like, we're intentionally making a bad movie to try to make the funny bad movie that's popular, like to try to make The Room, but intentionally make The Room.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think it was trying to be that level of awful, but like making an intentionally bad movie to try to entertain, it just feels so hollow when you try to do that. And I have no problem with actors making the transition to behind the camera, but I'm not interested in the Elizabeth Banks directing experience. I think she keeps trying and failing, and I think she's probably a well-liked person in Hollywood because she gets her friends to be involved in this, and this had a great cast.
Incredible.
You mentioned cast. Ray Liotta has our favorite actor Alden Ehrenreich is in it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you got all these great people popping up. It just wasn't funny. It was
no.
Like, the premise seemed really funny. It's like, oh, it's, and I think it came out in January or February of last year. Like, this is a great, like, let's go see this because there's nothing else out. It's going to be really funny. And it was just, it tried too hard. Like you said, it insists upon itself.
Yes.
And there's just nothing, very few. I laughed a couple of times. Like you said, it was harmless. It's not like it was this horrible, horrible thing, but it just was a lot of, Elizabeth Banks, I think, is really trying to flex that. Look at me, I'm funny. After I think she's kind of turned like serious.
But she is funny.
As a performer.
But she's like, I think the problem with Cocaine Bear is like, she didn't like go for it. It's this weird, I can see it being like the craziest movie you've ever seen if you've literally never watched like a slightly weird movie. You know what I mean? Like if like you've never seen like a Tarantino movie or a Sam Raimi movie or like a Coen Brothers movie, like I can see you being like your mind being blown by this movie. Like what? The bear sniff? What? That is crazy. Like
I read somewhere that their periods attract bears. The bears can smell the menstruation.
But if you've seen like movies, it's just pretty like
Yes.
Cute.
Yes.
It's like
that's
watching,
a really good way of putting it.
Like this is a movie like that's for It should be like for kids who like are just learning about movies, but it was made by adults for adults, and adults aren't gonna enjoy it because it's nothing, it's stale. It's nothing that they haven't already seen before.
I'll never be upset seeing Kerry Russell and Ray Liotta and Alden Ehrenreich, like I said, all these people on screen. Jesse Tyler Ferguson, I hadn't seen him in, you know, since the end of Modern Family. It was nice having him in this. So, you know, again, it was totally fine. I think it was mercifully like 90 minutes long. So it was nothing where I was like, oh my God, I cannot believe I just watched that. But it just was a misfire, to say the least.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe I'm personally, Mary brings this up a lot, is Elizabeth Banks is from Pittsfield, Massachusetts. She's from the Berkshires. She's from very close to where I grew up. And she seems like she's like embarrassed by that. She like never talks about it. She never brings it up. So I've almost had this retroactive, like, I'm not into what you're putting out. Sorry, Elizabeth Banks. You've made me laugh a lot on screen before, for sure. Don't get me wrong.
But Avery Jessup, one of the funniest characters, one of the funniest late era 30 Rock characters is her character on 30 Rock.
Absolutely. Which that has got to be, 30 Rock unrelated has got to be a rewatch for me soon, because that has come up so many times recently. What a great show. Yeah, she's perfect. Is she like a Fox News broadcaster on that?
No, she's MSNBC financial analyst, but she's basically, yes, she is essentially a Fox News personality.
Blonde, Jack is obviously drawn to. Perfect.
Yes.
Yeah, she's great. She's great in 40-Year-Old Virgin and Role Model, like, you know, all those late, even Zach and Miri Make a Porno. She was really good at that.
She's a funny person.
Yes.
I just think she's not a good director.
Yeah, exactly. And again, there have been plenty of performers who have made that transition. So it's like
John Stewart is another perfect example. Also a very bad director. Like, so,
I don't think I've seen anything he's made yet.
Not that great. Not that
okay.
great. But okay. But obviously, on screen.
Oh.
Like a beloved comedy icon. But just the transition to behind the scenes filmmaker, it's like, it's not really, the ideas are there, the execution's not there.
You know who else I think now that time has passed, it's like, oh, this has been a failed experiment, is George Clooney as a director.
Oh,
like,
God.
he had early good movies, and he's making like History Channel pictures at this point, and like made for TV Lifetime movies. You know, again, a very talented guy, and like, he doesn't have that, like someone like Ben Affleck or Mel Gibson. Like, they have that ability that I think Elizabeth Banks, John Stewart, George Clooney, I didn't think we'd group them together, but they just don't quite have it. And that's not to say that they're not talented. And and again, this was not a disaster if she wants to keep, but I think she needs to find something that's more, she was in the first Pitch Perfect. She might've been a producer on the first one. And it seemed like they kept losing.
She directed the third one or the second one.
I think the second one, because I think the director dropped out or they couldn't. Yeah. So it's kind of like, I'll direct it.
I've seen all three Pitch Perfect movies.
Oh, okay.
The second one's definitely the strongest.
Okay. All right.
The third one was really weird, though, if I'm remembering correctly. The third one has like a heist subplot. But yeah, like, she's funny in those movies. She those movies kind of had her whole like tone, sort of.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, if they had been made earlier, she almost would have played the Anna Kendrick part, maybe. But yeah, she might just, sometimes when like actors start getting more involved in behind the scenes stuff, it just becomes evident, like, oh, maybe they just have, you know, bad taste. You know what I mean? Like, they just, Ryan Reynolds, like, oh, maybe he just is boring and has bad taste in movies. And that's why a lot of his like non-Deadpool stuff kind of doesn't work, because he's just not that interesting of a guy. And it could just be that, like, Elizabeth Banks is really funny and a really good actor, but like, when it comes time for her to be like the overarching creative force behind something, it's just a sort of middle of the road and forgettable.
So I would not recommend this. If you see this post, it's a cool looking poster. It sounds good in theory. I know it was on Peacock for a while. I don't know if it's still on Peacock, but I would skip this one. Even if you like bad movies, this isn't that. It's just an artificially produced studio thing that doesn't work.
It's like Snakes on a Plane all over again.
Yeah, that's a good, very good.
That's a funny joke, but like, the movie itself is stupid. Like, it's just, there's nothing, we've talked about The Gray on the podcast before, the movie we thought The Gray was going to be. It was going to be like an exploitation movie about Liam Neeson fighting wolves, but it wasn't. It was actually a real movie, like a genuine movie, and that's why it worked. This was neither trash or actually a movie. It was just this middle of the road thing. It was just lukewarm. Yeah. So, who cares?
Around the same time, I watched Knock at the Cabin. This was also on Peacock. I really liked this movie a lot. I am very interested in the career resurgence of M. Night Shyamalan. I'm actually not kidding. I think his last four or five movies, he's made a couple of good movies in the last 10 years. Our podcast is turning into Why Is This So Hard? I think that's becoming our new theme. Like, why is making a decent movie so hard? Yes. And Knock at the Cabin is not Psycho or anything like that. I'm not saying it's like an excellent, excellent movie, but it's a really good movie. It's a very solid, enjoyable, same thing. It's like 95, 100 minutes with really, really good performances. I think that's the strength of this. Mm-hmm. And a simple enough, it's a perfectly suited M. Night Shyamalan plot.
Mm-hmm.
But like not a lot of information. It ends and doesn't give you that much more information, because that's something, another thing that you say all the time is people read their own press, right? So yes. M. Night Shyamalan has three really good movies. I know he directed like one or two other things, but his movies right out the gate, he had The Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, and Signs. In my opinion, all really good movies, but like you could see the rug being pulled out from you. Like you were starting to get ready for the twist. And yes. Then that mid 2000s era, I've actually never seen these movies because I just
hear happening tagline. It's happening.
I hear you whispering, planning on stealing something.
No, ma'am, we're not.
Plan on murdering me in my sleep.
What? No.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I intentionally skipped these movies where it sounded like he just had to keep trying to come up with ridiculous twists.
Yes.
And that's like all of the movies were only built on, well, what was the twist of this most recent M. Night Shyamalan movie? And he became like a caricature. And like, that's what he was known for, because he happened to have, especially in The Sixth Sense, this like remarkable third act twist that people, if you hadn't seen that movie, like you were not ready for that twist.
Mm-hmm.
So no, I haven't had the pleasure of seeing The Village or Lady in the Water or The Happening or The Last Airbender or After Earth. When I heard the ending of The Village, I was like, I'm never going to watch that movie. That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
I think that movie was the turning point for him. And I remember, I think it was after The Happening, there's a movie called Devil about people trapped in an elevator.
Yes.
And one of them is a devil, or the devil. And M. Night Shyamalan didn't direct it, but he produced it. And when I saw the trailer for that in the theater, his name came on screen and the entire theater groaned.
I had the same experience. It was before a somewhat big movie. It was like 2014 or 2015. And I was in a pretty full theater and there was the preview and his name came up. I'm not exaggerating. It was like the record scratch thing. There were groans of like, oh God, we're running this back. So,
it's fun. Like he's one of those directors that became like a household name.
Yes.
Like Hitchcock, but people see it. I reached a point where people saw his name attached to a movie and it was just like, oh God, like that's going to be stupid. Now I feel like that's changing, that it's become, oh, it's going to be like a dependable, sturdy little genre adventure. That's kind of shifted into, he's like, he doesn't think he's Hitchcock anymore. He's just some working director from the 60s doing like a Hitchcock ripoff. Like that's what he is now.
That is exactly correct. Yeah. He's, there's no longer this idea that he's a prestige filmmaker, that he's one of the great, you know, he's a good filmmaker. And I think reliable is a good word. So his last, I'm thinking the first good one again was Split. Split with James McAvoy. And like, I saw that. And that was also the rise of, that was one of the first appearances of Anya Taylor-Joy, who's now in everything.
With a genuinely good twist.
So like a movie that had a good twist, but it wasn't reliant on the twist, was my opinion of it. It like was good from start to finish, driven by an incredible James McAvoy performances, like a really good movie. And you could see why Anya Taylor-Joy has gotten so many roles since then. She was excellent in it as well. And then it, surprise, has this backdoor connection to Unbreakable. And then we get a sequel to both movies in the form of Glass. And Glass is not great, but I like it. It was fun. Well,
as Mike Stoklasa says, if you saw Unbreakable,
then gotta see Glass.
If you like Unbreakable and Split, well, then you gotta finish it. It's the last film and you saw the first two, so why not see the third? If you like Unbreakable and Split, well, then you gotta finish it. It's the last film and you saw the first two, so why not see the third? If you like Unbreakable and Split, well, then you gotta finish it. Bum, bum.
I certainly liked Glass less than Split, yes, but it was also like, same. It wasn't embarrassingly bad. It wasn't The Happening or anything like the mid-2000s Shyamalan. And then there was Old, which was a good movie. Like, I liked that. I watched that recently. It was a little bizarre, but like, it was,
you know,
it
was really good. Weird. Last night when I went to go pick up pizza for dinner, the pizza shop was Old was just playing in the
Get out of here. Get out of here.
And I was just like, I was like, what is this? Oh, that's that movie where the beach makes them all old. And I just think, so it's just funny that we're talking about this now. But yeah, just last night I was watching Gael Garcia Bernal conduct himself with dignity in a ridiculous
premise. But and I mixed this up with the other movie that should be called Old, The Visit.
Yes,
The Visit was good.
Older.
That was another one with a decent twist. Well, that one was a little more predictable.
That was, I think that's the movie. I think that's the movie where he realized, okay, I should just make, I have the filmmaking craft. Like, I can craft a good movie. I need to not take myself so fucking seriously, though.
Yes. And Knock at the Cabin, I think, probably has gotten the closest to re-entering into, like, this is very important filmmaking mood for him. But again, it came out in, like, January or February. The movie starts and the premise is like thrown at you immediately. It's like 5 minutes into the movie, and I'll share this because I think it's shared in the trailer. It's four characters show up. They're kind of like the four horsemen of the apocalypse, led by Dave Bautista. One of them is also Ron Weasley, which I love. It's fun seeing him pop up in things. They approach this little girl, and Dave Bautista has this, he has this presence about him where he's menacing, but the character is also like super sweet, which is interesting. Like, it continues through the movie that way, where he can play that delicate balance. He presents to these three characters, the world is going to end unless one of you sacrifice yourselves. We have to kill one of you. It's thrown at you immediately. And basically the movie never leaves this cabin. Mm-hmm. It becomes then very much a character drama among these seven people. And yes, they do the M. Night Shyamalan, Roland Emmerich thing where the news is used to show like, well, all these things are happening. So it's basically like every hour that something that we don't kill somebody, like there's going to be a natural disaster. So they put the news on. And it's like there's a hurricane, there's tsunami, whatever. All these things keep happening. Planes start falling out of skies. But I like that it's okay. We're getting global, but we're still remaining in this cabin. And it's how these seven characters are reacting to the news. It's not like the Roland Emmerich thing where you jump from government agency to government agency and they're all reacting to the aliens invading or whatever. So
New Mexico satellite station.
Correct. They don't do that thing. They just do like, here's the, it's like the local news basically. Yeah. It's like, but here's what's going on in X. I think it's like Maine is the idea. This little remote area. So
the scariest state in the union by far.
This for sure. Yeah. They go full Stephen King on you along with Dave Bautista, another performer I absolutely love. Jonathan Groff is one of the, it's a family unit. It's two dads and they have an adopted daughter. And another thing that get out of the way immediately, which I love, is the trailer was almost suggesting it. And you're like, oh, are these like four religious fanatics? And they're like, this, we're going to kill one of you because of this unholy union that you've created. And they immediately are like, this has nothing. Because I think the girl says, oh, my dads are inside. And Dave Bautista is almost like, oh, fuck, I was really hoping it was just going to be a straight couple. Like, it's irrelevant who the three people are. Uh-huh. It's like, we were told by whatever that we needed to come to this cabin, okay, and there was going to be a parent unit and a kid, and one of the three of you need to die.
That's so funny, because I feel like younger Shyamalan, it would have been religious fanatics.
And it would have been like, oh, you're gay, we're going to kill... Like stupid young Shyamalan would have done that.
Mid-2000s commentary.
Correct. Yeah. I think this was just like, hey, this would be... It'd be something a little different if it were two dads instead of... And it's like, hey, we can have Jonathan Groff, and who is gay in real life. He can be playing a gay dad. Like, let's do this. Yeah. Let's do something a little different. It's an adopted daughter, so that adds like a little layer to it. But pretty much immediately they're like, oh, we actually like right on you for being gay and having a kid. That has nothing, but we do need to kill one of you. But I'm like, oh, so then you don't think about it again. Like, they say it within the first like 10 minutes, and then that's like completely out of your mind. And it's now just a family drama. It really good. And it, 7 good performances, like good little kid actor. Wasn't familiar with who the other dad was, but Jonathan Groff is just great in everything. Ben Aldridge, I don't think I had seen him in anything else before, but he was good. Mm-hmm. Hour 40, good horror thriller premise with great performances, a satisfying ending, like a good third act. It didn't get stupid. There actually wasn't a twist in this one. It was like the premise was told to you immediately, and they stayed true to it the entire time, and it ended, and I was satisfied, and I just enjoy M. Night Shyamalan.
Yeah, and it's like you're just describing it, and it just makes me think of, we're just talking about actors that have boring tastes, and like someone that comes to mind, I hate to say it, is Dwayne Johnson. Like, a lot of his movies like are just like not that, like he's always good in them, but it's like this is what you want to be doing. And I think of another wrestler turned actor, Dave Bautista, who's every movie I've ever seen him in, I've enjoyed.
Like, yeah.
I've just always been like, well, that's a good movie. That's a fun part. Like, he just seems like a very interesting, like you said, he's incredibly menacing because of he's just physically gigantic, but he's also like so sweet.
Yes.
You just wanna hug him.
And he plays both of these elements in this role. Yeah. Like, he was an interesting character. The four horsemen of the apocalypse, basically stand-in characters, all had like an interesting backstory and were relatable and likable. And yeah, it was just like a good ethical thing. It was no fanaticism. It's like, I shouldn't say that. They are led to believe they need to do this thing.
It's like an episode of The Twilight Zone, but as a movie.
That's exactly it. Yeah. You totally understand all of the characters involved and what they're thinking and feeling, and just good heightened drama. Really well executed movie. I recommend it. Yeah, I get, you know, like a 3 out of 4 star, I would say. I think
love
that's
the
on
three star movie. Love the
three star movie. You can't, it's very reliable. You can't go wrong.
Yeah, the 3-star movie is very reliable. And the thing about the 3-star movie is it's like the widest spectrum of movie. Like, there's top tier 3-star movies, and then there's bottom tier 3-star movies. Speaking of bottom tier 3-star movies, bordering on 2-star movies, I'd like to talk about 2 cinematic works called Meg 2, The Trench, and The Pope's Exorcist. 2 pieces of absolute garbage that I watched this past year and enjoyed thoroughly. Meg 2 is the sequel to The Meg, which was an organic meme movie, like a movie that became a meme organically because they made the movie seriously. And that's why it is so funny.
Yeah. Okay.
It works everywhere that Cocaine Bear doesn't work. The Meg works because it's a giant shark, and Jason Statham is one of the funniest human beings that's ever lived. I don't know if he has a sense of humor, but he's just one of the funniest people ever because of how bald and serious he is. And then I was really excited for Meg 2 because it was the sequel to The Meg. It's based on a novel series, the whole world of The Meg. So I'm very excited for The Meg cinematic universe. And the guy that made it is like a really interesting, weird British director who's made A Field in England, which is this like LSD trip set during the English Civil War. He made that movie Free Fire that had like everyone in it about like a gun sale gone wrong at a warehouse. Like, he's just a very like kind of Tarantino light type guy. He's like one of the better Quentin Tarantino knockoffs. And so I was excited for Meg 2. It's not as good as The Meg. It takes too long to get to the Megs and to get to the people that live in the trench. So there's not enough Megs and there's not enough the trench. But there's plenty of Jason Statham. There's tons of famous Chinese actors so that the movie can be sold to China. It's just a lot of harmless stupidity that isn't hurting anyone and is just like, do you want to watch Jason Statham jet ski and fight Megs with like harpoon guns? Like, it's just stupid. It's like the kind of movie that you literally just turn your brain off and it's just like, that was fun. That was fine. Like I said, it's not as good as the first one. So if
that's a funny statement. Meg 2 the Trench is not as good as the Meg.
Nope, not as good as the Meg.
Okay.
So if you're for all the Meg heads out there, if you haven't seen Meg 2, see it, but it's not as good. But I like movies like that. I sometimes am just in the mood. I want to watch a movie, but I don't have the bandwidth. I want to watch a new movie. I want to watch something I haven't seen before, but I'm not ready to commit to like a real movie that will require my attention and me to think. And so I'll pick something that I haven't seen that looks really stupid. And so it's like, oh, I'll just spend 90 minutes and that'll be fun. That's what Meg 2 is. And that's also what The Pope's Exorcist is, which was a movie that I was very excited about. The guy that made Overlord, that World War II D-Day zombie movie that's really good.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I didn't know it was the same. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. Julius Avery, I think is his name. He made that movie Samaritan with Stallone. That's about superheroes. It's like a gritty superhero. It's like very 90s. It's like, this would have been awesome in the 90s, but now it's just like another thing on a streaming platform that's just like a thumbnail that just exists. The Pope's Exorcist is based on the life of a real Catholic priest, Gabriel Amorth, who's just a liar, who just makes up stuff with being an exorcist. And there was a great William Friedkin documentary, great because it's like not good. And William Friedkin interviews this guy and he's just like so clearly full of it. And Friedkin knows he's full of it. But The Pope's Exorcist is like a ridiculous, heightened movie version of this guy's life. And he is the Pope's Exorcist, played by Russell Crowe. Russell Crowe does an accent. Russell Crowe's
awesome. Fat. Oh, is it an Italian accent?
He talks like a DC.
Oh, yes. Yes. Okay. All right.
It checks a lot of my boxes. Russell Crowe is heavier. I love him when he's chubby. He's got a big scruffy beard and he does an accent. And I love when Russell Crowe does an accent. And the whole thing is that the Pope's counselors want to fire him. And he's like, I need to protect the Pope from the devil. and he just has to like go on adventures and prove that and get rid of demons with like his skeptical friend. And the Pope is played by Franco Nero, which is like awesome. It's like Django is the Pope and like the original Django.
Oh,
and
yes. Okay.
It's just Russell Crowe having a good time as he continues to financially recover from his famously expensive divorce. Like, it's just that's all it is. It's just Russell Crowe having fun with the fact that he's no longer the sexy stud muffin from Gladiator. Like, he's not that guy anymore, but people still like him. He's a very, very good actor. So he's having fun in movies like Unhinged and The Pope's Exorcist, where he's just like, I'm just going to fuck around. You know, I'm at my like Peter O'Toole in the 70s stage of my career. I'm an institution, but I need money. So I will just be in this absolute piece of trash about The Pope's Exorcist. I wasn't sure if I wanted to see it or not because I thought, oh, maybe it's just like a fun idea, but it won't be good. But I saw one scene from it on YouTube, and it's a very, very early scene where he's called to stand before the Vatican overseers or whatever. And they're just yelling at him about how you can't do exorcisms. You don't do them. Like, the movie opens with minor spoilers for The Pope's Exorcist. He tricks a demon into possessing a pig, and then they kill the pig with a shotgun in like a very graphic, comical way. And it's just like, okay, sold. And then he gets yelled at because he's doing exorcisms without approval. And he storms out of the meeting. But before he does, he says, like, my boss is the Pope. You want to fire me? I talk to the Pope. And he just storms out. And I saw that scene and I said, okay, that's like the worst Italian accent I've ever heard. This is such a great idea for a movie. And then I saw that it was directed by the guy that did Overlord. And I thought, okay, I got to check this out. And it didn't disappoint. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it thoroughly.
The trailer looked awful. I didn't remember that he had an Italian accent in the trailer, but you've really sold me on this one. Because there's nothing like a bad Italian accent is definitely the most humorous.
Yes.
Because it's like what everybody does as a joke, but then sometimes people actually offer that as their true Italian accent, like, yes, in a movie. Yeah, so now I'm just picturing his performance in Thor Love and Thunder as Zeus. So just Italian instead of Greek, which is probably in his mind like the same.
It sounds identical to his accent.
Yeah, okay.
In Thor. But I thought he was hilarious. Like, I liked that. I thought he was funny in Thor.
Oh, that was one of the best parts, yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah, when we talked about it. Yeah, I think we were a little soft on that movie, partially because we really liked his involvement in it.
Yeah.
And the idea of that and any future sequels. But okay, interesting. And I've been less, I haven't seen a lot of movies with Jason Statham. I haven't seen the Red Letter Media loves those
crank movies.
Yeah, I still have not watched either of those. I haven't seen any of the Transporter movies. I've seen like the ones where they're more legitimate movies. Like, was it literally just called The Bank Job?
He was the bank job. Yes,
yeah, like that was a good move, but that was like a normal movie. So I think I've kind of missed his whole. But I'm interested in the Meg because this one had a lot of attention and I know it's on Max. So maybe I'll give these a try if they're good, schlocky, entertaining.
Yeah,
movies.
he's just this bald. Again, speaking of accents that are just inherently funny, the Cockney accent is one of the most ridiculous ways that a person can speak. And it's just like, he looks like that and he talks like this. And it's just like, it's ridiculous. Like,
yeah.
And just the idea that he's an expert in anything other than just punching people is always funny. Having Jason Statham be like, I'm a marine environmental guy. I care about water. It's like, no, you punch people. Like, that's all you do. So right, that's right. Always fun. He's very likable. Again, I don't know how much of a sense of humor he has. Like, I can't get like a bead on him, but like, I always enjoy him in movies. And he's got like different genres. There's the Meg genre. There's the Fast and Furious genre. There's his like Guy Ritchie genre. So a movie like The Bank Job or Snatch or like Rock and Roller. And then he does like his action movies. Like, he's in that movie that just came out, The Beekeeper.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if he plays a literal beekeeper, but it's just like movies that like Charles Bronson would be in if they had come out in the 80s. Like, you guys know this guy. Here's the concept. Here's something for your dad to watch when he can't sleep. Just a stupid action movie. The Meg is like a little above that because it's like high concept, because it's about, ooh, it's a shark, but it's bigger. And then The Pope's Exorcist is like famous, beloved, highly respected actor, needs money. And so we'll do anything for money, but also has like interesting taste and finds and is like, oh, but this is The Pope's Exorcist. That's a great title. Like, sign me up.
You mentioned William Friedkin and you mentioned The Pope's Exorcist. I have not seen it. I should have asked you, did you see David Gordon Green's Exorcist The Believer?
Nope.
Okay, we'll have to, yeah, because that would be right in line with our previous Halloween discussions and that whole thing. But I have not had the pleasure to watch that movie yet. But
yeah,
yeah, this seems to be the year of a lot of possession movies, because I want to talk about two possession movies. And that was the Evil Dead Rise, there's no the, it's just Evil Dead Rise and Talk to Me. So I'll kind of be talking about both of them, I think, at the same time. But Evil Dead Rise is one of the more interesting continuing with a franchise movies, where I don't really understand what the goal is anymore with Evil Dead. And, you know, we talk a lot about
I just love that like Evil Dead, I don't understand what the goal is anymore.
I should put that on a poster. Yeah, it's just those, you know, we talk about lightning in a bottle all the time.
Yes.
And the first, you know, so there's been five Evil Dead movies now, and really they're actually all okay, they're all good, but the first three are really the only true Evil Dead movies, because they were very reliant on both the filmmaker and the star. Like, those are all Bruce Campbell, Sam Raimi, just nonsense that make three super entertaining movies, especially the two sequels. And
one's like the great, is one of those movies when you watch it, it's the greatest movie you've ever seen in your
absolutely
entire
life. Absolutely. And I'm forgetting, the series is very good too. Ash versus the Evil Dead on Stars. Mm-hmm. It's Bruce Campbell. It's like I can't think of many other series that are like solely reliant on the same performer. Mm-hmm. And he's the main character. He's basically the only performer in the second one, in Evil Dead 2. It's just him fighting himself and ghouls for 80 minutes or whatever that movie is. It's like 87 minutes long. Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness are just super entertaining horror comedies. Now, there was a remake in like 2013 or 2014. I think it was called The Evil Dead. And it was by a guy.
No, it was just Evil
Dead. Evil Dead. Okay, so the first one is The Evil Dead. Like Evil 1981, Dead. The Evil yes. Dead. And then it's Evil Dead 2.
Yes.
Army of Darkness.
which he wanted to call The Medieval Dead.
That would have been a great title. And that would have been a clever way of continuing having Evil Dead in the title. Yeah. But okay, then it's Evil Dead was the 2013 or 2014 remake. And that one was good. That was from, I think, Fede Alvarez. I think we've talked about him before, where he's... Yep. Made good movies. He did Don't Breathe, and he's making the new Alien movie that's coming out. He's kind of like a J.J. Abrams for horror, where he like gets involved in these pre-existing franchises. And then when he makes his own thing, it's familiar, but well-made, like a Super 8 or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Evil Dead Rise is a different, I can't remember, the director had made good horror movies before. His name's Lee Cronin. He had made something I had not seen before. The Hole in the Ground, I think, was the movie that kind of got him this job.
Oh, yes.
And this movie, to me, was sort of like something we've alluded to on the pod a lot, but we hadn't talked about, is Ghostbusters Afterlife. Is that what the fuck that's called? Where you make a sequel to a movie that's part of a franchise that has a completely different tone. And that's what this was. And that's what the remake kind of was too, where Evil Dead from 2013 was doing the same premise as the first movie, but had all different characters. So there's no new Ash or anything like that. It was like, let's just kind of redo a Cabin in the Woods movie. And it was a well-made Cabin in the Woods demonic possession movie, but it doesn't have the same humor and just awesome tone that Raimi and energy, that kinetic energy that Raimi and Bruce Campbell were able to offer in directing and performance. And this is the same thing, but what's more frustrating about this one, so I was like open to that kind of at the start, even though I'm like, it's called Evil Dead. When the title comes out, it's really awesome. You get this like opening vignette and lady comes out of the water and it's this big wide shot. And when she comes out of the water, Evil Dead Rise like drops from the sky as the title. Ooh. Like, oh, this is like, so it like looks great. It establishes itself as having this really like a more traditional horror movie tone. And then you are introduced to your human characters and it's all these great actors, good kid actors, family drama. But then the Evil Dead stuff starts and it's trying to insert that wacky kinetic stuff from the original three movies. But it's going up against this classy looking gothic horror movie. So it just, to me, it just didn't mesh very well. The third act has a fairly satisfying ending where it becomes more of like the Bruce Campbell, Sam Raimi movies. But then it's like, but that's not really the movie I was watching this last 90 minutes. So it's like, it looks really good. The performances are good. I liked a lot of the characters. I liked the overall story. It's one of those movies where I wish it wasn't called Evil Dead Rise. I wish it was called, generic horror movie title where it's just like a demonic possession
spooky,
thing.
Spooky Goobers.
Spooky Goobers 1, you know, whatever you want to call it. And if it just stuck with that, and then when the demons come in, if they're not being the wacky Evil Dead Deadites, if they're just being kind of like dark and more appropriate for the tone that is established in the first 30 minutes of the movie, I would have like loved this movie, I think. So it's weird like genre mashup that doesn't work, and kind of like the last Halloween that I didn't get to talk about, that was it Dave?
Me and Sam.
Sam talked about this well, where it's like it was this interesting idea, but then like the third act just felt like, oh, now we need to have Jamie Lee Curtis fight Michael Myers.
Yes. And
that's what this one was, where it was like, oh, it had all these great ideas and this great, it established like this awesome look and vibe. And then it's like, oh, but we need to have the Deadites be weird and like eyeballs need to pop out. And so for me, this was ultimately a miss, though it's not like a horrible movie. In fact, like I said, it has a lot of positive attributes, including its look and tone, especially in that first half or so.
Yeah. It's like IP is where all your ideas go to die. Like the restrictions of having to follow the rules of whatever universe you're working in. Like that's like the theme of the last 20 years. It's like, well, that would be a good idea if only it wasn't X, Y, or Z. It's like that show, The Orville. It was supposed to be a comedy. Yes. You watch it and it's just Star Trek The Next Generation, but without any of the names. And then every once in a while, there's like someone says like, yeah, Dick. And you're like, oh, right. This is supposed to be like a Fox comedy. But that's the thing. Seth MacFarlane isn't going to get hired to work on Star Trek The Next Generation. And no one's going to let him do just a straight sci-fi thing. So it has to be like a, there always has to be like an angle. Like it can't just be like an original idea.
Exactly. You know what was an original idea though? That was a good transition, was Talk to Me. Mm-hmm. So this is a much better possession movie that had an interesting initial hook that was different. So if you look at it on IMDb, it technically has 2022. It's one of those where I think when it was released in Australia, it's an Australian picture. Oh. I think it had a 2022 release date, but it was in our theaters this past summer.
Okay.
So I saw it shortly after it came out in streaming. I rented it on Prime. I don't think it's free on anything right now. But this is a classic. I don't have much to say about this other than it's really good. It's a it's a A24, like, super classed up horror movie, right?
Yeah.
Where it's all about the premise and really good kid performances also. Like, really good kid performances actually in this. Like, all the characters are either, you know, they're teenagers, so they're probably really in their 20s or whatever. Right. But then there is one boy who's definitely, like, only 14, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old. And the premise of this one, it sounds ridiculous, sounds ludicrous, but it's a great poster. And you see this, you see just the hand and like most of the wrist. And someone somewhere cuts off, digs up the grave or something of a clairvoyant, of a psychic medium, and cuts off their wrist and they like embalm it. So Ooh. Now it's, you know, so it's this like, it looks like a statue of an arm.
Yeah.
And if you shake hands with it and you say, talk to me, a ghost shows up. And then if you say, I let you in, you get possessed by the ghost. And it's like, it establishes all these rules quickly. How do people find out these rules? And how does this thing keep getting passed on and on and on? That sort of gets into spoiler territory, so I don't want to say too much of that. But basically, these Australian kids, and it kind of turns into a metaphor for using drugs and doing things you're not supposed to be using as a teenager, where they get their hands on this thing, no pun intended, and it becomes like an addiction. And they establish the rules very quickly. They're like, you can only have the thing in for 90 seconds, because if it's after 90 seconds, you run the risk of you're like permanently possessed
by a ghost.
And then so later it's like, how'd you get this? Oh, guy gave it to me. He didn't even want any money for it. He just kind of gave it to me. So it's like, oh. So it reminded me a lot of another really good classy horror movie from recent memory, It Follows.
I was just about to say, it sounds like It Follows in terms of just being like simple horror movie setup.
Correct. Where it's good characters, good story. You learn more about the main character, and her mother has died. So as she's doing this, at one point her mom pops up.
Mm.
And then she's getting all these different stories from how her mother died versus what her father told her. Mm. And she's someone who's really alone. She's an only child. She's lost her mother. She's only, you know, junior, senior in high school. She's kind of like a weirdo. So she doesn't have a lot of friends. So now all of a sudden she has this vessel to communicate with her mother. So it's a very, like you said, it's a simple, like, don't get bogged down too much in the, it's like, here are the rules. They establish them right away. You say, talk to me. You see the ghost. You say, let me in. The ghost is in. Can only be for 90 seconds. So of course it goes past 90 seconds at some point, and that's kind of where all the shit hits the fan.
Doesn't make any sense if you think about it, like, literally.
Correct.
But in the context of a movie, it makes perfect sense, and just roll with it.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. Don't worry about it. That's what It Follows is. Like,
yeah.
But it's the same thing where it's like, oh, this has been going on for a long time. And like, so we're met with the characters who now they're dealing with this issue, this supernatural issue now. But boy, talk about mood and tone and just very atmospheric and so well executed. Oh, and there is one star in this. Miranda Otto's in it.
Hey, great, yeah. It's not an Australian horror movie without Miranda Otto.
Miranda Otto popping up. And I don't really ever see her in anything with her natural accent. So that was nice to see this. And she's a really good character. Hmm. Her daughter is dating a nice Christian boy. And she says to her daughter, like, listen, you know, he can't be here after whatever hour, like curfew, blah, blah, blah. The daughter's like, oh, he goes to Bible camp. Like, he's saving himself for... And Miranda Otto immediately responds, you know what? Whatever the daughter's name, I'm going to say it's Jessica. You know what, Jessica? He still has a dick. She says it in her Australian accent. I'm like, this is great. She's wonderful in it. I love Miranda Otto. So really good movie. It's one of those movies that stays with you. Like, I keep thinking about it a couple weeks later. It's like, that was, really well executed. I highly recommend that. I'd say that was one of my favorite movies of the year.
Oh, wow. Okay. It's going on my list.
Yes.
It's going on my catch-up list.
I also want to talk about Thanksgiving.
Ah.
Yeah, which is also one of my favorite movies of the year, and that's no joke. I'm not an Eli Roth fan. Haven't been. He's another guy who I saw some of his movies and just, it's like, this just isn't me. He just screams like an immature adolescent Boston asshole.
The Boston thing is the main thing for me, that he's from Boston is what's...
Oh, and that pops up in this movie. That still... So to give a brief, Eli Roth is... Well, he's probably not even that much older than us, right? He's probably only like in his... Maybe he's like early 40s, maybe...
I think we're older than him, actually. I think he's at 22.
But he made Cabin Fever in the early 2000s, and he made the Hostel movies, and he makes a lot of trash that to me is not like entertaining trash, but he's always had this relationship with Quentin Tarantino, where Tarantino has loved his stuff, but Tarantino loves trash. He's always loved trash. So Eli Roth is like his modern, it's a contemporary. He gets to like interact and have a relationship with a guy who makes trash, unlike someone in like the 50s, 60s, 70s who Tarantino would grow up watching that guy's trash, but he just now has it in the form of Eli Roth, and they've had this kind of like off and on relationship over the last 20 years. Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez made the movie Grindhouse in 2007, and it was a double feature movie. It was an homage to 1970s. You go see these trashy, cheap horror movies where it's a double feature. You see one and the other. So Tarantino directed the second movie, Death Proof, and Robert Rodriguez directed the first movie, Planet Terror. But both before and in between, a lot of famous filmmakers made little trailers for fake movies. Two of those movies have now become real movies. One of them, Robert Rodriguez directed one himself called Machete that featured Danny Trejo. And there have now been two Machete movies, which I'm actually not that big of a fan of. I thought I would love...
No,
they're like not good. It's kind of actually, to go full circle, those are kind of like the Cocaine Bear thing where it's like, oh, these are intentionally bad movies, but they're like not that fun. Unlike Planet Terror is awesome. I'm a big Planet Terror fan, like a really fun, stupid movie.
Yeah.
But anyway, getting bogged down, one of these fake trailers before Death Proof was Thanksgiving that Eli Roth directed. And it's an obvious Halloween homage where it's a... holiday horror themed thing, and it's in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And I love this. I don't believe this is true, but in this universe, Plymouth, Mass, since it's where Pilgrims and all that, Plymouth Rock, it's like Thanksgiving is their fucking, like, that is their day. Halloween isn't a big deal. Christmas isn't a big deal. Thanksgiving is the holiday that this town just like gets jacked up for and unites. And it's like a small town, blah, blah, blah. It didn't really feel like Plymouth to me, but for the purpose of the movie and the purpose of this killer, it's like, we're going to just make it Plymouth, Mass.
Yeah.
And again, Eli Roth is from Boston, so that makes sense. Whatever. This fake trailer, shout out to Nick Foshe, friend of the pod, former guest on the pod. We have just loved this fake trailer since 2007.
It's good. It's really good.
It's very funny. It's all in the visuals and the performance. Michael Biehn's in it, which is great. I wish he had been in this movie. But 16 years later, Eli Roth makes the movie Thanksgiving. I had really no interest in it other than I felt like I owed it to Eli Roth. Like, we've loved that trailer. Like, okay, whatever. But this is the most mature movie Eli Roth has made. even though it's still a ridiculous horror movie. But he seems like he's, it's kind of like a James Gunn thing with him too, where I feel like he's finally like, okay, I'm an adult. And like, yes, I still love these silly movies. This is like, he's finally figured it out with Thanksgiving, in my opinion. It's a good looking movie, but more importantly, it's funny. It's not immature. It's good humor. He strikes the balance perfectly of making, it's not a Halloween ripoff. Like, yes, it has Thanksgiving as the title. And yes, that holiday is incorporated very much into the movie, but it's just a good horror comedy. It's kind of like a, maybe not Shaun of the Dead level comedy, but it reminds me more of something like that.
Yeah.
Where in this movie, you know, it felt very dated. I leaned over to Nick at one point and said, is this set in like 2005 or six, where the opening scene is like 2021 and it's Black Friday sales are starting early. They're starting the night of Thanksgiving. It's Plymouth. It's this local, you know, like a, it's not quite Walmart big. They're starting their sales early, starting like 8 p.m. Thanksgiving night. And there's only a couple like security guards there, but like thousands of people show up and they like break down the doors of this store to get in on all these sales, and like chaos ensues. People literally die like because they're trampling each other and that sort of thing. But, you know, so I'm a little bit like, 2021, like this would have been better like before Amazon really took over the entire world, and like because people used to do this and be crazy about it, and it's like not really a thing anymore. So I kind of wish it was like 2007. But point being, someone was clearly lost somebody and was upset, and a year later for Thanksgiving starts murdering numerous people involved with like who worked at this superstore and like blah blah blah. It's involving a bunch of teen characters. The lead actress is really good in this. I can't remember her name. There's like a TikTok star who's just frankly in the movie because she's very good looking, is Addison Rae. But she's actually not a, she's like not a bad actress either. Like all the male leads are in it. There's good misdirection as to who the killer might be. Patrick Dempsey's in the movie. Gina, blanking on her name, Showgirls, what's her name, Gina Gershon's in it.
So
it's like it's got good adult actors in it too who kind of carry the movie. It's just really, the kills are like really funny, you know. It's like one of those where again I'm saying, oh, he's matured so much, yet I'm like, but all the murdering and the violence is super entertaining. But again, I think you know what I mean, there is an intelligence to that, and there is a maturity to it, and he seems like he's finally made it.
Yes.
So this was just a really good three acts, good premise, good initial setup, good kills in the middle, and then a very satisfying twist in third act, in my opinion. And I just loved it.
It sounds like his latest movie is like as assured as like Edgar Wright's first movie, which is really, like, he's not as good as his contemporaries as far as like guys that grew up on certain types of movies and now get to make movies. It's like, it's Eli Roth, Tarantino, Edgar Wright, Robert Rodriguez, Kevin Smith's in there. Like their whole thing is just like, I love movies. And like, it's definitely like a spectrum of talent. And I would put Eli Roth like maybe like above Kevin Smith, maybe as far as like filmmaking talent go, like craft.
For sure. For sure.
But he's on the bottom. He's on the lower. There's like Rodriguez, Tarantino, Edgar Wright. And then there's the other guys who are just kind of like doing their thing, but not as good.
This seemed like a big step forward. I saw the movie he made a couple years ago, Knock Knock, with Keanu Reeves and Ana de Armas. Premise was a little ridiculous. Keanu Reeves is like a good dad. His family's away on vacation because he's working on whatever job. And these two total babes show up at his door and he sleeps with them. And then they like make his life a living hell. And it turns out that they're both, they just like go around and do this to people. So that to me was like, yeah, that's Eli Roth still not there, where he's like, literally it's like these two women are just out doing this to do it. And there's no like, I'm like, what's the message of this movie? Now seeing it, and Keanu Reeves actually ad-libbed and had a very hilarious line in the third act of the movie that I was like, good for you, Keanu. It was like a good Keanu performance, good, reliable Keanu movie. But the movie itself was just dumb. Like, again, what I'm saying, like, this, he's just immature, where he's like, I'm going to have these two absolute hotties. Who wouldn't sleep with them, right? And it's right, like that right. sort of thing. And like, but then they're out to get the guys who do it. And it's like, what are you saying with this picture? I don't know what you're, are you saying men are bad or women are just out to trick you? Like, it had that. That's the level of complexity we were talking about.
He's like your friend. He just never leaves the town. And he's just always that way. Like,
yes.
Like you see him and like you have kids now. And he's like still making like gay jokes. And it's like, Eli, we don't do that anymore. And we shouldn't have done it then. Like, what are you doing? Like, he's like, that's why the whole Boston thing is like so important to me with him. Is like, he just reminds me of some guys like I went to school with.
Yes. Like,
and is he even from Boston, or is he a classic guy from Boston who's not from Boston, who just says he's from Boston?
As like it might be that, actually. I mean, he's definitely from Massachusetts.
He is, yeah. But like, is he really from, like, Needham and just tells you?
We're going to find out right now. That's probably it. He was born in Newton, Mass. There you go.
I was so close.
You were so close. You should. Right. So he's. But again, that's also the joke of like, if you're from that whatever circumference, it's like,
yes, basically, you just say you're from Boston.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Exactly. Yeah.
But this movie is not that guy.
Yes. Yeah.
I watched this and I'm like, I don't think, oh, this is a classic Eli Roth movie. It's like, no, this was like a good, entertaining horror movie where I watched this 50-year-old man grow up before my 33-year-old eyes, and he's finally made it. So yeah, if he, and this could become like a little series, and I'm actually not necessarily opposed to that. It feels like this is a perfect one-off also. So I hope this doesn't turn into Halloween and those other, where it's like just bad sequel after bad sequel. But if he has legitimate stories in mind that he wants to continue, and if he brings this perspective, then I am on board with the Thanksgiving franchise.
Yeah, because that's the thing, like a simple one-off premise that then gets stretched into a long franchise can sometimes end poorly, which I think maybe now we should talk about John Wick 4.
Good transition. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, well, why don't you start, because this is one that we've both seen.
Yes. So I liked the first John Wick movie when it came out, what feels like 35 years ago. Like,
no kidding.
I thought it was, I liked it. It's like a good premise. This like heightened world of assassins and this guy, John Wick, like he's so cool. And Theon Greyjoy pissed him off and now he's in huge trouble. Simple, lots of fun. Love Keanu Reeves. I've always loved Keanu Reeves. I love it when he gets a part that jibes well with his abilities, and John Wick is like a really good part for him. And then John Wick 2, also fun, but still sort of like, still that like heightened world, like this whole mythos of these assassins and hitmen. Like it's New York City, it's the mafia, it's all stuff you know from other movies, but it's just like ratcheted up just a little bit. And by the time the third one came around, I have to say I was like, okay, I got it. I'm getting a little like sick of this. And with this fourth one, John Wick Chapter 48, it doesn't have a subtitle, right? Because the third one had a subtitle.
Which is annoying because only the third one has a subtitle. I hate things like that.
Really annoying. Just a feeling of, okay, I no longer get any pleasure from seeing people efficiently killed in action movies now. Like I'm sick of this. Mm-hmm. And what happened, I saw John Wick 4, and just a couple days before that, I had watched RoboCop with my brother. He hadn't seen RoboCop before, and he wanted to, so we watched RoboCop.
Oh, which also came out in 2014, just like John Wick 1. You're talking about that RoboCop, right?
Of course. Of course I'm talking about that RoboCop, directed by no one and starring no one.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
No, we watched the original RoboCop, and as I was watching John Wick Chapter 4, all this like balletic action, highly choreographed, and I'm thinking, none of this is as good as the warehouse scene in RoboCop where he just comes in and starts shooting people. And I just found myself thinking, I don't like that this has become a new genre of action movie. The guy that efficiently kills people and is never in danger, and it's like, that's the choreography is standing in for what you're really supposed to be reacting to in action scenes, which is the visceral thrill of squibs and gore and like tactile, like, I don't know. So with this fourth one, I remember thinking like, no more John Wick movies. Like, I don't even know if we needed this many John Wick movies. Like, I'm bored. This is boring now. They had that Bob Odenkirk one that was just, it's John Wick, but it's Bob Odenkirk. And it's just like, no, thank you.
It was a good movie. See, I liked that movie. Did you see it?
I liked it, but it was just like, like, I get it. Like, he's just going to kill people in cool ways. Like, I just miss the, I don't know. I'm bored by it.
You bring up legitimate concerns, especially with the action pieces. The first movie was so refreshing to me because I liked that efficiency killing angle where I was hearing my stepdad and in the back of my head where he's one of those people who counts how many bullets are shot from a gun and he knows how many are left, how many rounds are left. So he'll be like, well, that's bullshit because he ran out of ammo three scenes ago and I didn't see him reload. And why don't you just shoot him in the head or something like that? So that first movie, I love that John Wick is just like, I am headshotting all of these people to make sure they are dead and then moving on to next guy. So I thought that was almost like refreshing and it was kind of a neat change up. It was a good new action movie. So I agree. Like the first one and the second one kind of satisfied that itch for me. But what was impressive and what I think continues to be the strength of this series now is I did love the world building and the mythos and all these ideas of these hidden assassin cults and locations and groups and rules. So that continues to work for me. And then what this fourth one did that was interesting and unexpected is this kind of started off as a dumb series of action movies directed by, I believe, the guy or people who have directed these movies were originally stunt people.
So yeah, that was their whole thing. They wanted to make like a showcase like for stunt people, basically.
Yeah, so we're not talking auteurs, but we've like witnessed the birth of an auteur right before our eyes that I think culminated with this one, where this fourth movie was The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It was John Wick, but The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It was 2 hours and 45 minutes long when the other ones were all hour 45, something like that. Maybe the third one hit 2 hours. I don't know, but
yeah.
This one was this super long thing where like I was invested in the other characters and three of them are constantly undermining each other and they're all trying to reach the same goal. And I remember I even thought to myself, this is kind of like The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And I read later that that was a clear inspiration for the movie. And you have shots that are homages to Lawrence of Arabia. And like, trust me, I know this movie is not Lawrence of Arabia. I'm certainly not comparing it. But I also don't think it's like embarrassing that it's referencing Lawrence of Arabia. Because it's like, boy, these movies are starting to look a lot better as they go on. But I also agree with you in your point where by John Wick 4, that's 2 hours and 45 minutes long, I am far less interested on just the action set pieces. Like,
yeah, like I missed the days of the first one and to a very large extent the second one, where it was just like watch Keanu have cool fight scenes. Now we're like referencing Lawrence of Arabia. It's like, come on, let's John Wick. Like who I don't know. Like that's my thing. It's like, let's not forget where you came from. Like you're just a silly action movie that's like a little darker and has like slightly different edge. Like I know there's like a Peacock show that's all about the hotel, about Ian McShane's character when he was young. It's like really like it's just a bang bang punch punch movie. Like why are we investing so much time into like, is it that interesting of a world? Like I don't think so. Because for me
yeah I kind of am into it. I don't know. I like that mythos type thing. I like world building like that. I like how we slowly learn a little bit more about all these things. So I'm not ruling it out, but I'm very like, I have my toes dipped in the water right now. Like I'm not convinced I want more. Like I haven't watched The Continental. They're making an Ana de Armas either, speaking of Keanu, and they're making either a movie or a TV show about the ballerina thing from the third movie. It was Angelica Houston, right? She was the head of like, so like, I love that. I love that in New York, there's Russian ballet assassins in the underworld. I don't know. Like to me, so
it's like a comic, it's like a heightened like comic book.
That's
the world.
And like, can it earn this? Like, can these silly action movies that started that way eventually get to the point of being like a legitimate franchise that is a little bit more prestige? Like, I don't know. I'm not going to say no yet. But yeah. I'm also not certain either, to your point.
Well, I'm going to say no.
Okay.
I'm going to say no. And even if they could, I just don't think they should. That's my thing. It's just like, don't. Just come on. Like, this was just like a one-off thing. He loves his dog. You ruined his car. Like, let's watch him get his revenge. Like, I don't know. I don't need this much from this world. So I'm at the point where it's like, no, it's a no for me.
You're done.
I'm done. Yeah. I don't need any more John Wicks.
Okay.
I don't want any more John Wicks.
Well, I'll briefly end. You already referenced Nobody, which I see. I like, I guess it's just like different enough for me. And maybe it's, I guess I don't see as many action movies as I used to see. So if there's a movie like this every once in a while, I'm game for it. And one of which is Sisu, which is like the same producers as John Wick. The trailer aired before John Wick 4, and it's set in Nazi Germany and Finland, which is not an area I'm typically think of when I think of World War II in Europe at the time. But it's the same type of thing where it's this guy who's looking for gold. He has this tragic past. He's this like awesome soldier. He gets entangled with Nazis and he starts killing Nazis in really entertaining and fun ways. So this one to me was at least different enough where it's not just to shoot him up, punch him up. It gets a little bit more creative in the deaths and the violence. And it's like, who doesn't mind seeing Nazis get absolutely destroyed and blown up? So
always good. I mean, always good. Always a fun thing to watch.
So John Wick 4, you're getting conflicting information. If you've seen all the John Wick movies, I would see it. I hear Danny's concerns. We'll see where that series is going. And then if you're looking for a fun 90-minute Nazis getting absolutely murdered by a no-talking Finnish man, then check out Sisu. That one's on Stars right now.
And if you would like to return to the simpler days of like 1997, where all kinds of movies were available and you could just, there was a movie for everyone and movies weren't so loud and complicated and it was just about guys talking in rooms, I highly, highly recommend William Friedkin's last movie, The Caine Mutiny Court Martial, which is a movie that essentially does not exist because it came out on streaming. Hardly anyone saw it. It's a real shame because William Friedkin was one of the best directors, American directors, he was a master, and this was his last movie. And talk about a guy that didn't really lose his fastball, like ever. That's a phrase people use, right?
Absolutely, I know sportball.
Yeah, yeah. We've been talking about old directors. Friedkin just loved making movies, and that was like contagious in all of his movies. And this one, it's basically, if you've seen The Caine Mutiny, it's just the court martial scenes from that movie, but as the whole movie. And it's just filled with guys. Lance Reddick, Jason Clarke, Kiefer Sutherland. No one is better at playing armed forces assholes than Kiefer Sutherland. He is the best one at playing just military guys that are indignant at you giving them any guff about anything. Like, it's just, he's so good at it. I really, really, really enjoyed this movie. It's like such a great last movie for Friedkin to go out on because it's, the subject matter is so old-fashioned. Like, he was such an old-fashioned guy. He was so no-nonsense. Because of how old he was when he made it, they needed to have a backup director on set. And so Guillermo del Toro was the backup director. And he said, like, I didn't have to do anything. I basically just got to get a front row seat to William Friedkin. Just
directing
the shit out of like this great courtroom drama as like no one else can. It's like Lance Reddick's last movie. Speaking of John Wick 4,
I was just about to say, we should call this for our friend Lance.
Yeah, it's just like we've talked about in the last couple episodes, like how hard is it really to make a good movie? When you know what you're doing, it's not that hard. Like a courtroom drama is like the most simple like movie setting. Like you talked about Knock at the Cabin, it's just the one setting, it's just interesting characters, genuine drama and stakes, and like that's what this movie is. It's just like, it's about this destroyer captain who may or may not be military nuts, and let's figure out if they were right to, you know, mutiny against him. And it's just like a simple story. It's the right way to do like a remake, because the Humphrey Bogart film The Caine Mutiny was very famous. It's got a bunch of famous actors in it. It's why Michael Caine is called Michael Caine, because he needed to change his last name and he saw a poster for the Kane Newton, and he thought, oh, Kane, okay, I'll go with that. And this movie wisely says, well, we're not going to do the whole thing. We'll just do the courtroom scenes. We'll just do that. That'll be our angle. It'll just be a courtroom drama. And because at the time it was made, they couldn't make the character that Bogart plays and that Kiefer plays, Captain Queeg, they had to sort of tone down his madness a little bit in the 50s, unsurprisingly, and make it a bit more like sympathetic. In this one, because of the time it's made, you don't have to really worry about that kind of stuff. And Kiefer can just do the full indignant, you know, army asshole or Navy asshole thing. And it's great. It's really great. Jason Clarke, we've made fun of him because he's, you know, Sam Worthington, Jason Clarke, Jai Courtney, Joel Edgerton, they're all just the same guy. But Jason Clarke, maybe he shouldn't be lumped in with those guys because he shows up and stuff and he's always like interesting. He was in Oppenheimer. Like he's much better than the rest of those indistinguishable Australian guys.
Yes.
So if you just want to watch a movie that's just about guys in a room doing like dialogue, the Kane Mutiny Court Martial. It's a shame that it's a movie that's like inaccessible to most of the people that would want to watch it.
Yeah. Kiefer's done a few Paramount/Showtime because Paramount and Showtime now have a streaming dynamic. He's done a few things with them that it's like, what is that? Well, that's the world now. It's like Kiefer Sutherland has a show on, I can see the poster. I don't even remember what it's called. It's not Designated Survivor. He did a show like after that was on either Showtime or Paramount Plus. Oh. I don't even know it because no one ever saw it. And then you mentioned this to me. I had seen the Kane Mutiny years ago and I thought, what is he talking about? But that's a good idea. It was called Rabbit Hole is the show I was talking about.
Okay.
Sure. There you go. So yeah, he's kind of disappeared after like post 24. He hasn't really had a Designated Survivor felt like one of those shows that like when its first season aired, that was when you'd still watch potentially a broadcast TV show. So we watched like the first season plus of that show. And then I was like, no, TV is dead. It doesn't exist anymore. I think that and The Good Place premiered on like the same night. Yeah. That was kind of the last gasp of watching like network television for me. So I haven't seen Kiefer in a long time. And knowing that it was William Friedkin's last movie and that Guillermo del Toro was on backup to direct a courtroom martial for Showtime or whatever this was, that's interesting to me. So I'll have to check it out.
That strikes me as like a classic Billy Friedkin like joke. It's like, we need someone to take over in case you die. And he's like, okay, I'll pick the guy who's maybe like the least suited to make this type of movie.
Yes.
And Del Toro said yes because he's like, awesome, I'll just get to sit there while I watch Friedkin make a movie. Like, that sounds awesome. Sign me up. It's hilarious. Like, it's just a great William Friedkin. If you've never like seen interviews with him, he's one of the most entertaining guys of all time. Like, he just is like, no bullshit. He's made some of their best movies. He's very funny. Can't stand Al Pacino. He's a funny guy.
Yes. And to go full circle, there are some funny jokes. He passed away in the fall, right? He died in like October, November.
Yeah.
So he's the director of The Exorcist. And he had some sort of quote of like, I hate David Gordon Green for making Exorcist Believer. Like, I'm gonna whatever. And shortly after he died, David Gordon Green got fired from the second Exorcist soft reboot. So a lot of jokes of like William Friedkin beyond the grave made sure that David Gordon Green wasn't allowed to make any more Exorcist movies.
He got up to heaven and he talked to Father Gabriel Ormuth, who beat him there, and he set them all up and they sent Catholic wizardry to destroy David Gordon Green's career.
Good for them. David Gordon Green needs to go back to just doing episodes of The Righteous Gemstones and Pineapple Express movies. He should not be touching Halloween or Exorcist any longer.
That's the meta theme, I guess, of this episode, is people should remember their station in life.
Yes.
And stick to what they know.
Yes. Keanu, M. Night Shyamalan, Elizabeth Banks. There we go. That's our full circle summary of this episode. So so a bunch of movies that came out last year based on our recommendation. If you're interested, check them out. And like I said, we're going to check back in with other catch-up review episodes from what came out this past year.
We're finally going to talk about Barbenheimer, for example.
Finally going to talk about, just in time for the Oscars, we're going to rewatch, have a revisiting of both Oppenheimer and Barbie. So that'll be coming soon as well. Thank you very much for listening.
You don't want to sell your death sticks.
I don't want to sell your death sticks.
You want to go home and rethink your life.
I want to go home and rethink my life.